So as we pick up in chapter 20, Abraham has been dwelling in Hebron, and of course, following the historical account, we have just come through the account of the destruction of the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. And so after the destruction of those cities, Abraham journeyed from where he had been to the south and dwelt between Kadesh and Shur and stayed in Gerar. Now, we're not told why Abraham relocated at this point. He went about 50 miles south and west of where he had been, and it doesn't seem that it was that good of a move. Doesn't really say one way or the other whether or not the Lord was leading him to move. It just simply tells us that he did move. But then it says this, "Now Abraham said of Sarah his wife, 'She is my sister.' And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah." So this is where things get really interesting and a bit confusing, really. Because remember, this is the man of faith. This is the father of faith. This is a man who's made some mistakes, but yet recovered. And seemingly up until this moment had, you know, kind of a thorough recovery from some of those early lapses of faith. He's received the promises of God. He has entered fully into the covenant that the Lord had made with him. He has had personal, face-to-face conversation and communion with the Lord. And now, strangely and amazingly, we find him lapsing once again in faith. It hardly seems possible that this kind of a thing could be repeated, but that's what we have here. Some Bible commentators say, no, this is just a repeat of what happened earlier. I don't know how they come up with that, but that's one of the theories. This is clearly a second incident where Abraham fails to trust God and he sort of pawns off Sarah as his sister. So, this is what he does. "But God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, 'Indeed, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is a man's wife.' But Abimelech had not come near her, and he said, 'Lord, will you slay a righteous nation also? Did he not say to me, "She is my sister"? And she herself said, "He is my brother. In the integrity of my heart and innocence of my hands, I have done this." And God said to him in a dream, "Yes, I know that you did this in the integrity of your heart, for I also withheld you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now, therefore, restore the man's wife, for he is a prophet. And he will pray for you, and you shall live. But if you do not restore her, know that you shall surely die, you and all who are yours." So Abimelech rose early in the morning, called all his servants, and told all these things in their hearing. And the men were very much afraid. And Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, "What have you done to us? How have I offended you that you have brought on me and on my kingdom a great sin? You have done deeds to me that ought not to be done." Then Abimelech said to Abraham, "What did you have in view that you have done this thing?" And Abraham said, because I thought, surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will kill me on account of my wife. But indeed, she is truly my sister. She is the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. And it came to pass, when God caused me to wander from my father's house, that I said to her, this is your kindness that you should do for me in every place wherever we go. Say of me, he is my brother. So, amazing. Abraham's lapse of faith. You know, the astounding thing is that Abraham trusted God for the extraordinary, but didn't trust him in the ordinary. He trusted that God could give him a child, to give a child to him and Sarah when she was 90 and he was 100 years old. He was firmly convinced that God could do that, but he didn't, or somehow couldn't, trust the Lord to preserve his life. It's strange, but common. Strange, but common. We can trust God to get us to heaven, but we have a hard time trusting him to take care of us here on earth. Isn't that the truth? You know, we just entrust our eternal souls to him. Oh, Lord, thank you that you saved me. We have absolute confidence that we're going to heaven. But boy, the moment anything goes wrong here on earth, we just lose faith so quickly. And we begin to doubt. And we begin to fear. And we begin to wonder, you know, does the Lord love me? Is he really with me? And so we see with Abraham, as much as he was a great man and a great man of faith, he still had these areas where there were inconsistencies. It's interesting to me that this is something that goes way, way back in his past, way back to the very beginning of the call of God. Now you could understand it initially, perhaps. God calls him to leave his country, to go out from his family. He's got a beautiful wife, and so he's afraid that he might be, killed as they would attempt to take her. And so, you know, they make this deal together. Sarah goes along with it. And you can sort of understand it a little bit at the beginning, because after all, he was new in the faith, and he hadn't really learned to depend on the Lord or to trust the Lord, or he hadn't really, come to that place of a maturity in his faith. But it's astounding that at this stage he would be repeating the same kinds of things. But it's almost like he sort of had a pre-programmed sort of a condition here, or a pre-programmed bent toward failure. You know, this is just something that we planned. And so, amazingly, he just, instead of simply trusting God. Now, remember, the Lord has promised you're going to have a son. He's going to be your heir. I'm going to bless you, give you a multitude of descendants. You're not going to be able to number them. You know, God's told him all these things, and none of that's happened yet. Now, you would think that with all of those promises, Abraham would have just said, oh, we're going into Gerar, no problem, don't worry about it. The Lord's going to trust us. The Lord's going to protect us. I'm going to just have confidence in him. He's going to keep us, because after all, he has to fulfill his promises to us. You would think that that's what he would do, but, unbelief is rather irrational. It doesn't really make any sense. This doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But this is just the way we are. This is human nature. And we have seen over and over in the scriptures themselves, you can see it repeated in church history, You can find it in people around you, and I would imagine you could find it right in your own life as well. You know, great feats of faith on the one hand, and then irrational moments of unbelief on the other hand. I mean, think of Elijah. What a great example. You know, Elijah has the faith to overcome and to defeat Ahab and all of these prophets of Baal. And, you know, you remember the contest he has with them there on Mount Carmel. And, you know, he's so victorious and he's so full of faith. I mean, he's to the point where, you know, he's even mocking the prophets and he's mocking Baal. And he has this tremendous victory over the prophets of Baal. God comes through. You remember the story. And he answers by fire. That's what Elijah said. The God who answers by fire, let him be God. And so you read this story where Elijah just has this tremendous amount of faith and, you know, just this fantastic victory on Mount Carmel. They slay all of the false prophets, and there he is just in the midst of victory, and suddenly word comes to him from Jezebel, of all people, the queen. And she says, God, do so to me, and more also, if by this time tomorrow you're not like one of these prophets. And what does the great man of faith Elijah do? He runs for his life. He runs for his life. I mean, talk about inconsistency. Talk about irrationality. I mean, on the one hand, wouldn't you think that he would just say, well, you know, bring it on, Jezebel. The Lord just gave a great victory here. I'm confident he's going to give a great victory here. But we see these kinds of things happen. And we ourselves, at times, do these things. We can trust God for extraordinary kinds of things. And then some ordinary thing comes along and we lose it. Well, as you consider this, we can all just thank God that his plan is not dependent on men. Because if that were the case, we would all be hopeless. Because there's not a man among us. And, you know, here's the best of them, Abraham. I mean, he's it. He's the father of faith. And look what he's doing. And so once again, we see in this story as well as the weakness and the folly and the faithlessness of man, we see the faithfulness of God. We see in the story how God overrules Abraham's folly and his faithlessness. And we see here that there are times when God will directly intervene to prevent us from messing things up. God will directly intervene. We might be going in a certain direction, but it's the wrong direction. And the Lord will step in. You know, we'll get to this a little bit later as we carry on in Genesis, but I think of Isaac later on. Isaac, who knew full well that Jacob was to be the one to whom the promise would pass, the blessing would come. And Isaac, knowing that, because he's a weak man, because he has a preference for Esau, who cooks him better food than Jacob does, because of those kinds of carnal types of things, he's willing to just forfeit the whole plan of God. And he is trying to pass the blessing on to Esau instead of on to Jacob. But God circumvents it. He doesn't allow it to happen. And even later in Genesis, when Jacob is blessing the sons of Joseph, Jacob knows that Ephraim is going to be blessed above Manasseh. And so he lays his hand on Ephraim to bring that blessing. And Joseph says, no, he's not the firstborn. And Jacob says, oh, You're right, but he is the one. But so often, we as weak people, we will at times, in our weakness, we'll be going contrary to the will, the plan, the purpose of God. But again, thank God, his plan is not dependent on men. He will intervene. And that's what he does here. I mean, if this, you know, if God hadn't intervened, who knows what would have happened? Abraham is obviously at this point, he's not thinking about anything but himself. He's ready to jeopardize the whole plan of God. Now, this happened evidently shortly after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. It was going to be within a year that Sarah would have Isaac. So it's possible that she's either not yet pregnant or she's perhaps just newly pregnant. And Abraham allows her to go into a situation where the whole plan of God is potentially jeopardized and Sarah is potentially compromised. But we see God stepping in and dealing directly with the situation. Now, here's something that's even more astounding. What does God say to Abimelech about Abraham? He says he is a prophet and he is going to pray for you. Now, this is probably one of the greatest demonstrations of the grace of God in all of the Bible. Because when you just look at the story as it is, Abimelech is obviously the more righteous person in this situation. Abraham is the one who's deceiving. Abraham is the one who's not trusting God. Abraham is the one who's trying to, protect himself ultimately. And Abimelech is just, he's sort of an innocent victim in some ways. I like what he says in verse 10. Abimelech said to Abraham, "What did you have in view that you have done this?" I think to translate that into the modern vernacular, Abimelech said, "Abraham, what were you thinking?" That's what he's saying to him. What did you have in view? What were you thinking to do this to us? But God, he speaks of Abraham not disparagingly. He doesn't even, give any kind of a rebuke regarding Abraham to Abimelech. He simply says he is a prophet. Now, this is the first time in the scriptures that the word prophet appears. You would think that it would have waited for a better example. But this is the first place. But there's a lesson in it. And here's the lesson, simply. God's servants are, at best, still men, and men are sinners, prone to weakness and failure. We make a huge mistake when we put too much confidence in people. We make a huge mistake when we put too high of expectations upon people. And many people have been let down. Many people have been stumbled because they put too high of an expectation on a person. We have to remember this. We have to realize, and I think there's a number of reasons, but I think one of the reasons why the Bible records for us all of the foibles, all of the failures, all of the faults of everybody in it, is just to remind us that this is just the way people are. Now, it's astounding with all of those reminders over and over and over again that we still have that problem of sort of idolizing people, of sort of putting people up on a pedestal, of, sort of expecting more from them than we ought to. Unfortunately, people haven't learned the lesson by just, reading the scriptures. Sometimes we have to learn the lesson the hard way. by putting trust in a person and then that person disappoints us. But we need to remember the best of men. We all have feet of clay. And at some point, you know, everybody's going to let you down with the exception of one, and that's the Lord. The Lord won't fail you. The Lord won't let you down. That's why it's so important to keep your eyes on the Lord. Boy, you get your eyes on men, you can get stumbled so quickly. But we've got to keep our eyes on the Lord. But just, you know, a couple of examples. I think you get the point, but I'll illustrate it a little further. You know, think of David. Well, let's back up a little bit. Think of Saul. Boy, to David, Saul was a hero. Saul was, the first king of Israel, and David certainly had a great admiration for Saul. But Saul turned out to be rotten. And you can only imagine the disillusionment that David probably went through. But then David himself. We find that David, as great of a man as he was, he had weaknesses. He had glaring faults. And you know, when you study through the life of David, I mean, sometimes I look at people like Joab and guys around him, I think, those poor guys. Man, that was tough to be close to David. Because here's God's man, here's this great king, this great warrior, this great man of faith in so many ways, but in so many other ways, he's doing all the wrong stuff so often. Of course, we know most obviously the sin with Bathsheba and then the follow-up with Uriah. But as you follow the whole story of David, you find that so many other times as well, in his family dealings, he was a miserable disciplinarian. His family was out of control, and he was relatively powerless to do anything. He just didn't do anything about it. So we see that with David. We think of somebody like Jonah. You know, here's a prophet who doesn't even want anybody to repent. He's disappointed that God's sending him to potentially get the Assyrians off the hook. You know, it's interesting because when you read Jonah, the reason Jonah did not go to Nineveh wasn't because he was afraid of the Ninevites, wasn't because they were, they were a fierce people. It wasn't because of that. Jonah didn't go to Nineveh because he had a sneaking suspicion that if he went and preached, God might forgive them, and he didn't want that to happen. He wanted God to judge them. And so that's why he fled. Then, of course, you know the story. God eventually gets him there. He walks through the city and just simply proclaims destruction is coming in 40 days. And what happens? There's a great repentance and there's a great, revival, if you will, that breaks out. And then where does Jonah go from there? He goes and sits down under this gourd and he's just depressed out of his mind because God forgave these people. Now, this guy's a prophet. Well, think of Peter. Peter's the classic New Testament example of, you know, a guy who on the one hand, he's full of faith, he's full of zeal, but on the other hand, he's always making all kinds of mistakes. He's prideful. He thinks he's better than the other disciples. You know, he swears loyalty to Jesus. I would never deny you, Lord. I'll even die for you. And then he denies that he even knew the Lord. And then after all of that, we come to the period of the book of Acts, and we find him going to Antioch, and then he's there with the Gentiles, and he's just having a great time, but certain people come down from Jerusalem, from James, and he's afraid, he's intimidated, so he shuns the Gentiles, and he goes into a full hypocrite mode, and Paul has to rebuke him publicly. The point is simply this. We all have feet of clay. And learn this lesson. Don't trust in men. The best of men will let you down. Trust the Lord. Look to the Lord. You know, so many people say, oh, I don't, Christianity and church, and I'm going to, it's a bunch of hypocrites. Well, you know, the whole world is full of hypocrites. And certainly there are hypocrites in the church. But you know, here's the truth. Jesus was no hypocrite. And there's no place in the Bible where God ever said to look to any other person. God calls us to look to Christ. And Jesus never failed. Jesus will never let you down. Your expectation of Jesus cannot be too high, because he'll never disappoint. But even somebody as great as Abraham, we see that here he is. He's a man. He's a prophet, all right. And he's going to pray for Abimelech. And God is going to bless Abimelech because Abraham prays for him. But at this point, his testimony as a prophet isn't really a good one. But in verse 14, we read that Abimelech took sheep, oxen, male and female servants, and gave them to Abraham, and he restored Sarah, his wife, to him. And Abimelech said, see, my land is before you. Dwell where it pleases you. Then to Sarah he said, behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Indeed, this vindicates you before all who are with you and before everybody. Thus she was... Some translations read she was vindicated. Others read she was rebuked. I think the way he said to her, your brother, I think it was a mild rebuke. Because she had, of course, agreed to that. And so Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech, his wife, and his female servants. Then they bore children. For the Lord had closed up all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. And the Lord visited Sarah. And he said, or as he said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had spoken. For Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age at the set time of which God had spoken to him. And Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore to him, Isaac. He called him Isaac. Remember, the Lord said, call him Isaac, which means, of course, laughter or rejoicing. And think about it now. 25 years have passed since the promise which was originally given, since the call to leave his country, to come out of Ur and to go to the land that God had promised him. 25 years. He was 75 when he left. And now Isaac is born to him at 100 years of age. You know, as we've mentioned before, and we'll mention it again because it's a continual theme in the scripture, you have need of patience, that after you have done the will of God, you might receive the promise. God does not do things according to our timetable. And we see that here. 25 years. But yet, here's what we also see. God is faithful. If God has spoken a promise to you, and it hasn't yet happened, and a long time has transpired, don't give up. Don't give up trusting the Lord. Because if he's spoken a promise to you, he will bring it to pass. You might have thought that that should have happened a long time ago. And I'm sure there were times when Abraham thought the same thing. We know that he thought the same thing. He voiced that on a number of occasions. But God has the perfect timing. And we don't understand that. But he knows just the exact time. And as sure as he's given us promises, we can be confident that he is faithful and he's going to bring it to pass. And you know what's going to happen when those promises are fulfilled? There is going to be rejoicing. There's going to be laughter. There's going to be praise. It's going to be, oh, it's going to be so thrilling. Because we see, yes, God, He's kept His word. He did just what He said He would do. So don't lose heart. Remember a couple of Sundays ago, we finished the message with that great word from Psalm 27. I would have fainted unless I had believed to see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait on the Lord and He will strengthen your heart. I would have lost heart, but we need to just keep on believing. God's going to come through. He's going to keep that promise. But for whatever reason, reasons only known to God, He oftentimes will, you know, He'll take things right to the very brink, won't He? He'll allow us to be pushed right to the limit where you just think, I can't go any further. But He'll come through at the appointed time, and that's what we see here. And so Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. Now Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him, and Sarah said, God has made me laugh, and all who hear will laugh with me. She also said, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? For I have borne him a son in his old age. So the child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the same day that Isaac was weaned. Now, in that culture, at that time, there's different estimations as to when a child was weaned, what their age was, but most would agree probably about 3 years old. So now 3 years have passed without any details given. And it's come time for Isaac to be weaned, and Abraham, as we read here, he is preparing a great feast. But look at verse 9. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, scoffing. Ishmael was about 16 years old at the time. And here he is, as Abraham is rejoicing and throwing this feast for Isaac, Ishmael is scoffing. Now, no doubt there was a tremendous amount of jealousy that had come in. Ishmael was Abraham's only son. And for 13 years, he had that position in the heart of his father. But now he has obviously been replaced to some extent in Abraham's affection, because, of course, Abraham was his wife. And Isaac was the child of promise. But remember when we talked about Ishmael previously, we talked about how Ishmael was, he was Abraham and Sarah's attempt to help God out. He was the byproduct of the flesh. And in one sense, and you know, I don't want to sound harsh or insensitive in saying this, but you know, in one sense, Ishmael was never supposed to be in the picture. But he comes into the picture because of the impatience, because of the weakness, because of the refusal to rely on the Spirit and the moving into the realm of the flesh to help God out. And now Abraham is faced with a tremendous emotional struggle. And as we pointed out before, we have to be so careful not to become impatient not to have a lapse of faith and try to take things into our own hands and not trust God and get ourselves into the flesh, because in doing that, we can end up producing things that will be a grief to us for years to come. This is something that we really have to be on our guard against. Because we all have the potential to do it. We all have the capacity to do it. And so this attempt to help God will be an ongoing source of pain for Abraham. Because obviously he still loves Ishmael. But look what happens. Therefore she said, Sarah, to Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son. For the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, namely with Isaac. And the matter was very displeasing in Abraham's sight because of his son. Oh, you can just imagine the pain in Abraham's heart over this. He loves Ishmael. And now Sarah is demanding, she's requiring, because of this jealousy, because of this scoffing and this mocking of Isaac, she demands that Ishmael be sent away. But God said to Abraham, do not let it be displeasing in your sight because of the lad or because of your bondwoman. Whatever Sarah has said to you, listen to her. Listen to her voice, for in Isaac your seed shall be called. Even the Lord says Sarah's right. It was a painful, painful thing for Abraham. And you see, this is what happens. We potentially set ourselves up for trouble and for pain when we go about and produce something in the flesh, that thing just becomes a grief to us. Because there will come a time as we enter more fully into the promise of God, there will come a time when God's not going to allow that thing, that fleshly thing, whatever that thing might be, he's not going to allow it to remain in his presence. It might have been something that we put so much time and effort and energy and everything else into, and God says, no, I don't recognize that. I won't acknowledge that. That's not part of what I'm doing. We think, oh, but Lord, you don't know how much energy and time and devotion I gave to this. And in a sense, you know, what it really comes down to, it was a waste of time and energy and devotion. So we have to be careful. I believe, personally, I believe very much in a specific call of God for our lives as his people. I believe very much in a specific plan that he has for us. And I believe very much that just like these stories we read in the Bible, God gives promises and then in a process of time, he works those things out. And we go through seasons of testing and sometimes we ourselves are tempted to jump in, to get in the flesh, to somehow try to make something happen. And if we succumb to it, if we do it, we will live to regret it later down the road. Doesn't mean that we're, you know, completely out of the blessing of God. We might very well enter into a great time of blessing later, but we've still got this thing we're dragging along with us now. I've got this ball and chain hooked to me that I can't get rid of. Because I wasn't patient. I didn't wait. And with that same kind of pain and intensity that Abraham would have felt in having to send Ishmael away, we can go through those types of things as well. As you look at many of God's servants, you find that there are these kinds of patterns in their life. There are promises that are made. There are obstacles that come that, you know, seem to indicate that the promises are never going to be fulfilled. And then there's those seasons of, you know, having to wait on the Lord and trust the Lord, and there's plenty of temptations that come along with that to try to make it happen yourself. We see that with Jacob. We'll see that clearly when we get to Jacob. We see with David, there was, you remember, God promises David the kingdom. He anoints him as king, but Saul is still on the throne. And there's so many opportunities for David to take things into his own hands, and so many people around him are saying, do it. Now's your opportunity. This is the time. Here's Saul. God's delivered your enemy into your hands. Kill him and you can be king. And it would have been so easy for David to just say, yes, I'm going to do it. But David had a sense that, no, I can't touch this. This is the Lord's thing. I have to just let it run its course. But the temptation was there. What if David would have done that? Would it prevented him? Would it have prevented him from becoming king? Not necessarily, but it would have created a whole new set of problems for him. And so you see, that's the thing. We don't want to create an Ishmael, if you will. We don't want to create something because we didn't trust God, because we weren't patient. We didn't wait for that right person. Instead, we were hasty and just, well, here's a person and I'm getting old and I'm just going to get married. Or here's a job and I can't wait on the Lord anymore. I've been waiting and I'm just going to take this and move my family off. And you find you're out in the wilderness somewhere. There's no fellowship. You've cut yourself off from that and now you're strapped to this job and it's not what you thought it was going to be and you're miserable and you hate it and you didn't wait for the Lord. And many things can be like this. So God says, cast him out. But God says to console Abraham, yet I will also make a nation of the son of the bondwoman because he is your seed. So Abraham rose early in the morning and took bread and a skin of water, and putting it on her shoulder, he gave it and the boy to Hagar, and he sent her away. Then she departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba. And the water in the skin was used up, and she placed the boy under one of the shrubs. So evidently Ishmael was faint, and so she pushed him under one of the shrubs. And she went and sat down across from him at a distance of about a bow shot, for she said to herself, let me not see the death of the boy. So she sat opposite him and lifted her voice and wept. And God heard the voice of the lad. Then the angel of God called to Hagar out of heaven and said to her, what ails you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad and hold him with your hand, for I will make him a great nation. Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. And she went and filled the skin with water and gave it to the lad and drank. So God was with the lad, and he grew and dwelt in the wilderness and became an archer. He dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt. Notice something. Did you notice how the word God is used rather than Lord? Notice it was the angel of God. And then notice on every occasion, it's God that is used, it's Elohim that is used, rather than Yahweh. And I think that that in and of itself is indicative of the fact that the covenant is not with Ishmael. Remember, God said, I'm going to bless him because he's your descendant, but my covenant will be with Isaac. And Yahweh is the covenant name. The name by which we know God because we are in covenant relationship with him. And in that name, I am that I am. He is to us all that we could possibly need, and he will be to us whatever we might need. But in the name Elohim, it is simply the name for God in the sense of God as the, you know, the supreme being in a sense. But Elohim does not convey any personal type of a relationship. And I personally think that the use of Elohim here rather than Yahweh is indicative of the fact that Ishmael is not part of the covenant. He's acknowledged by God. He's helped by God. And to a certain extent, he's blessed by God. But he's not part of the covenant. And again, I think by way of analogy, there are things as well that we can attempt for the Lord in the flesh that God acknowledges them to some extent. They bear some amount of fruit, but the covenant is not there. There's not that covenant blessing, that abundant fruitfulness. But God watches out for Ishmael. Now, the common belief is that Ishmael is the father of the Arabic nations. That is debatable. Perhaps he is, but more than likely there were many others that were would ultimately be the father of the Arabic nations. Of course, in the Quran, or amongst the Muslims, they, as we pointed out before, they believe in Abraham. As I mentioned before, their Abraham is more of a mythological character. He's not the Abraham of the Bible. They deny that the covenant was from Abraham to Isaac. And although the Quran doesn't state specifically that Ishmael was the recipient of the covenant, that is somewhat implied. And so, of course, that's what Muslims believe today. They believe that Ishmael is the promised descendant from Abraham. And, of course, they see themselves as the direct descendants of Ishmael. But whatever, you know, in the long term, whatever happened with Ishmael, the Bible follows his history just a little bit further, and then we leave off because he's not part of the, as you know, he's not part of the covenant, so he's no longer part of the story. But that Isaac and Ishmael did have some sort of an ongoing relationship, we know, because they came together at the death of Abraham, and they together buried their father. And so, verse 22. And it came to pass at that time that Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, spoke to Abraham, saying, God is with you in all that you do. Now, Abimelech is a title rather than a name. So it's sort of like Pharaoh. Abimelech would be the title of the king. So whether this is the same Abimelech as previously, we're not sure. But obviously would be his descendant, if not actually him. So they came to Abraham saying, God is with you in all that you do. So now some time has passed from the last situation, of course, before Isaac was conceived and born. So now some years have transpired. Now therefore swear to me by God that you will not deal falsely with me, with my offspring, or with my posterity, but that according to the kindness that I have done to you, you will do to me and to the land in which you have dwelt. And Abraham said, I will swear. Then Abraham rebuked Abimelech because of a well of water which Abimelech's servants had seized. And Abimelech said, I do not know who has done this thing. You did not tell me, nor had I heard of it until today. So Abraham took sheep and oxen and gave them to Abimelech, and the two of them made a covenant. And Abraham set seven ewe lambs of the flock by themselves. Then Abimelech asked Abraham, what is the meaning of these seven ewe lambs which you have set by themselves? And he said, you will take these seven ewe lambs from my hand, that they may be my witness that I have dug this well. Therefore he called that place Beersheba, because the two of them swore an oath there. So Beersheba means the well of the oath, or the well of the seven. Thus they made a covenant at Beersheba. So Abimelech rose with Phicol, the commander of his army, and they returned to the land of the Philistines. So these guys are Philistines. These were the original Philistines. They came early. They would come in a much larger proportion later, but these were the first Philistines that came into the land. Then Abraham planted a tamarisk tree in Beersheba, and there called on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. And Abraham stayed in the land of the Philistines many days. So, Abraham planted a tree and called on the name of the Lord. You know, Abraham was a worshiper of God, and this was an act of worship, really. We have made the mistake of thinking of worship strictly in terms of singing songs. And it, you know, it's really kind of unfortunate. And it's something that it's almost like we can't get away from it, you know. Every time we, so often every time we just speak of worship, we're, you know, in the context, we're speaking about the singing part of the service or whatever. But, you know, the Bible only connects worship with singing one time. The many, many times that worship is used in Scripture or the term is found, it's only connected with singing one time. Now, praise, of course, is connected with singing most of the time. But I think it's important that we understand that worship is a whole lot more than singing. Worship is really the offering up of our lives to the Lord. And here is a demonstration of Abraham's worship. He's just wanting to worship the Lord, so he plants a tree and just says, Lord, this tree's for you. And worshiping God is the giving of ourselves to Him. It's the giving up of sacrifice. And of course, the greatest act of worship is, as Paul says in Romans 12, to present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to the Lord, which is your reasonable service. That's the translation that we are familiar with from the King James and the New King James. But another translation is, which is your spiritual act of worship. Present your body a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual act of worship. So you see, worship is not simply singing. You know, I hate it when I hear people say, you know, oh man, I go to this church and, you know, I don't really like the teaching, but the worship is so good. You know, whenever somebody says that to me, I think, now, what is that saying? Basically, what you're telling me is you feel good when people are singing there. And then, what does that mean? Is the end of worship so I feel good? Is worship about me feeling good? And if I didn't feel good, then the worship was bad? No, see, worship isn't about me feeling anything. Worship is about my life being given to God as a living sacrifice. Remember, Abraham, as far as we know, he didn't sing any songs. At least we don't read about it. I mean, maybe he did, I don't know. We're never told in Scripture. But he was a worshiper. And he worshiped with his life. And he worshiped by giving to God. I think of David, when David wanted to build the temple for the Lord. And he wanted this particular plot of land. And so he sent a message that he would like to purchase this plot of land. And the man said, oh, well, I can't sell it to you. You're the king. You want to build the house of the Lord on it? I'll just give it to you. David said, no, I won't let you give it to me, because I will not give the Lord that which cost me nothing. You see, in David's mind, there needed to be sacrifice. There needed to be something that cost me something in giving back to the Lord. And that's what worship is. It's a sacrifice. It's the giving over of our lives to God for His glory, presenting our bodies a living sacrifice, that is our spiritual act of worship.